From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at the week in news, politics, and more. Coming up,
Governor Asa Hutchinson travels to Cuba in hopes of future trade deals.
A shutdown of the federal government is narrowly averted, despite the votes of Arkansas's congressional delegation.
The Little Rock School District announces plans to build two new schools.
The Little Rock Film Festival says its last movie has been screened.
Former Governor Mike Huckabee builds a southern firewall, but is it enough?
And former President Bill Clinton returns to Arkansas for the dedication of the Anne Frank tree.
I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
That's all coming up on KUAR's Week in Review podcast. Governor Asa Hutchinson is back in Arkansas after going over to the communist island nation of Cuba. He went along with a delegation of almost 50 Arkansas business leaders and state officials for a series of meetings there. Jacob, you covered a press conference here upon his return. What did the governor's mood seem to be? This obviously is viewed as a major untapped market, 11 million Cubans who, for a lot of industries in Arkansas, especially agricultural, really see as a good market, a good place for Arkansas to do trade with.
You know, it sounded a lot like you spoke with him earlier in the week from when he was in Havana via telephone, and didn't sound like he got more upset or any more happier over the course of the week. He seemed in good spirits. He said he liked the communications he made. He hoped to nourish these relationships in the future. And he said that the main challenge, though, coming up is, he says, Arkansas has products for Cuba. Cuba seems like they're interested in some of these products, but really it's going to be up to Congress to act for anything to happen. And he says that could be a matter of months, it could be a matter of years, but he hopes Congress does something. And the biggest step that he wants to do is allow Congress for companies in America to open up credit with Cuba. Because right now, Cuba can already buy products from Arkansas, but only on a cash basis.
Right.
And because of that, Cuba doesn't have as much buying power as they would have with, say, Brazil or Vietnam or some other country like that. So he said that's what's going to have to happen. But there were some kind of novelty things to his visit. He said that he was told this was the first time an American flag was ever in one of the minister cabinet rooms in the Cuban government. Asa Hutchinson brought the flag with him, I guess, or it was there anyway. So, you know, he was clearly excited to be there.
Yeah.
Steve Barnes of ATN said, well, it seems like you're in tune with the Obama administration a little bit on Cuba policy, which is like something you're not supposed to say to a Republican, that they'd be in tune with the Obama administration. So Asa Hutchinson kind of smiled and he said, well, you know, not so fast. I'm much more cautious than him. I don't want everything lifted, and I want it very gradually if things like the embargo and travel restrictions are lifted.
Yeah, this does put him at odds with a lot of his fellow Republicans. There are many who have spoken out against the lifting of some sanctions and the gradual renewal of the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. He did acknowledge, too, that there were some issues that, you know, he is doing this while you still have Castro in power there.
Well, the governor did say because the Castro regime is still in power and it's a communist country more so than China or Vietnam would claim to be today, that no matter what, if businesses want to invest there instead of just trading but really invest there, it adds some uncertainty to them because maybe the government will step in and say, well, we want a 50% share of the company, or these are the regulations, and it's a more unpredictable environment. But on the other hand, almost the entire world has been trading with Cuba for a number of years now and seem to be fairly comfortable with and have long-standing business relationships. Governor Hutchinson did mention that Vietnam and China are both investing in infrastructure, and the Cubans have told them before that they want to respect their traditional trade partners as well, who have had their back for decades.
Why don't we listen to just a little bit of what Governor Hutchinson had to say on Friday?
It was remarkable because as I went and met with the Minister of Trade, and then also they have the Council of Ministers, which is the overarching governing body for the centralized government. And I met with the deputy minister there, and he remarked that this is the first time that the American flag had been in the Cuba building at the ministry that we had the meeting. And it was also the first time that the ambassador, De Laurentiis, had been in that building. And this just reflects the historic time of re-engagement after literally 55 years of broken diplomatic relations. And also, just to give a picture of Cuba at this historic juncture.
I was wondering, if I may interject, since this was a business trip and given the island nation's well-noted tobacco products, of course, topping off any good business trip is a Cuban cigar. Did the governor indicate whether he sampled any items such as that?
No, we mostly stuck towards the serious issues about, you know, extending credit to buying things like to make rice purchases easier. But he did mention that it was beautiful at times and that he saw classic cars.
Of course, you've got the 1950s era cars that people in Cuba have been able to keep going. That, and you've got the Russian cars, a lot of 80s models there. The governor did indicate that he did get some time to actually look around the island, also referenced playing basketball while he was down there with some people. So, but said that he wants Arkansas to be at the front of the line when trade opportunities do come up. And worth mentioning, too, he did have a lot of the biggest companies in Arkansas, representatives of these companies, mainly agricultural companies, Tyson, Riceland Foods, along with him on this trip, and just hoping to plant the seed for future trade opportunities.
Yeah, and he really didn't promise anything. He said there are no contracts signed while he was there or anything like that, nothing in the immediate. He still thinks it's a long way off, and it's a lot like the Hutchins administration from the beginning of his campaign said, I'm going to travel, I'm going to personally try to recruit industries and businesses and make these deals happen. Hasn't always had the best luck so far, but it's still pretty early.
The Little Rock School District announced plans this week to build a new school in southwest Little Rock while converting an existing building into a middle school in west Little Rock. KUAR's Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, you covered the announcement. First, tell me a little bit of the background, the politics, and what went into making this announcement.
Well, Michael, back in January, before the school board was disbanded, when the state took over the district, they had come to a consensus about facilities plan that would involve a building a Southwest High School and a middle school in West Little Rock. So Southwest Little Rock is a more disadvantaged, diverse part of town, and West Little Rock is primarily white and wealthier. And there had been a real split on the board between interests, particularly led by Joyce Springer and Jim Ross and other members of the board who really wanted to champion focusing resources on the schools in need in the city beyond the six schools in distress. And then Leslie Fiskin and others who really were advocating for building in West Little Rock. And part of the justification for that is that as the schools deteriorate in the district, kids who have the means are being pulled out and taken away, and the district's losing that the resources that come with having those kids. And so they say, you know, we have to compete in order to save this district, and this is our first priority. So the board came together at the 11th hour before the state was going to make its final decision on the takeover and found a compromise. And this was a part of their communication with the state to try to say, you know, we can work together. Don't take over the state. Don't disband the board. Look, we have a plan. It's that we'll build both these schools at the same time, and we've worked it out. And then, of course, the state did take over. This is the first building plan that Superintendent Baker Curris has announced. And, of course, his predecessor, previous Superintendent Dexter Suggs, when he was in the interim role running the district, he didn't actually make any plans either. There have not been any wide-ranging academic plans. So this is the first concrete plan of any form. And to clarify one thing, the middle school plan isn't definite. The district has under contract 23 acres of land, which has a warehouse and another office building that could potentially be used for a school. And that's next to another tract of land it purchased 2 years ago. But what needs to happen is a feasibility study, and the contract will last for 180 days and is contingent on the district being able to use the buildings or make a plan to build there.
That would be a usable location.
Yeah, so the tract next to it was purchased with a middle school in mind, but they need to hash out the details of, you know, what these buildings could really be used for. It's a $11.5 million contract right now. So Baker Curris, Superintendent Baker Curris, yesterday made the announcement and said that he wanted to stay true to the intent of the compromise reached by the board. Of course, one key distinction is that these two schools won't have to be built in tandem.
Which was part of the original plan.
Exactly. And he said that the West Little Rock Middle School might actually be ready as early as next year if it's found that the site could be used, whereas a high school is going to take 4 or 5 years to build, and that needs to begin with a community engagement process, and it needs to be thought out carefully. So they're not on the same time frame. Let's hear what he said yesterday.
Okay.
Both of these announcements relate back to January the 22nd, in a fashion, which was the date the school board met and passed some resolutions authorizing the construction of a new Southwest Little Rock High School, as well as the construction of a West Little Rock Middle School. Now, those resolutions were premised on millage campaigns and a number of other things, so perhaps they're not directly applicable, but yet they indicate the board's desire at that point in time to proceed along parallel tracks in both Southwest Little Rock and West Little Rock. I think that's the prudent course of action right now for a lot of different reasons. We have need in both areas that's demonstrable. I'm in those areas all the time. We're responding to those needs. We also have competition in those areas that very strong competition that's growing. I think it's time to meet that competition. So I'm going to announce two things today. The first is that we're going to initiate a community engagement process with respect to what we need in Southwest Little Rock. I want to plan, design, and construct a new world-class high school in Southwest Little Rock. If you look around in the communities that surround our school district, our facilities are not as good as they are in other areas. We need to do the same thing here, and we have to start somewhere. Designing and constructing a new high school will be a 4 to 5 year time frame. It takes a long time to plan, it takes a long time to design, and it will take several years to build. So it's we don't have the luxury of waiting right now. We need to proceed quickly.
And what's the plan for how to pay for this?
Well, Superintendent Curris has been looking at ways to allocate some capital funds. He thinks the district hasn't been doing a good enough job allocating funds for capital investment. The district does face a $37 million loss of desegregation funds starting in 2017, but he, as you know, has a business background and has been looking for every way to cut corners and downsize. He's made it clear there are going to continue to be staff downsizing in the days to come. And of course, he's renegotiating the teachers union contract, potentially decreasing bargaining rights with the union, which is supposed to be released by the end of this month. So from a businessman's perspective, he's looking for ways to increase some small facilities investments and make cuts all around.
This week, Congress was able to avoid a government shutdown. This was, Jacob, a rather divisive issue. A lot of talk about this, and much of it centering on Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, and this issue has been building for several months now, since about the middle of the summer when those Planned Parenthood videos came out, secretly edited videos about a pro-choice group that wants to end abortion that had to do with fetal tissue research. And so that was it was all involved in this vote about a continuing resolution, or a CR. It's about funding a lot of essential government services, and essentially if Congress had decided not to continue funding the government, as of midnight on Thursday, some services would have started to shut down. What they ended up passing a temporary stopgap measure, so the government will continue until December 11th, when they'll have the same argument again. And everyone in Arkansas's congressional delegation, except for one, Steve Womack in Northwest Arkansas, voted against this measure to avert this government shutdown. And he said, well, of course I'm opposed to Planned Parenthood like every other Republican in the state, but voting against continuing the government funding would have nothing to do. It wouldn't work, basically. It wouldn't work. But I spoke with Congressman Bruce Westerman of the 4th District, much of Southwest and West Arkansas. And he said that he voted against this measure because he said the proper order of things had not been followed, but he did not necessarily consider it to be a betrayal by outgoing Speaker John Boehner, who some say has negotiated a deal with Democrats to keep the government going.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a betrayal. I would call it a sign of the times, and I think it's a rut that we've gotten into where we fail to follow regular order and we fail to pass appropriation bills, and then we cave into the Senate and pass these continuing resolutions. And my opposition to the continuing resolution was mostly about being a voice to say we have to get back to regular order. We have to start running government the way the Constitution intended for us to run government, and that's through the appropriation process.
And Ted Cruz had been much harsher, and he voted in the minority of Republicans in the Senate along with Cotton and Bozeman against this deal to keep the government going. He's indicated that he thought John Boehner was sort of betraying conservatives on the issue of life. There's also a series of national protests this week of Planned Parenthood Day of Action. There's one in Little Rock at the clinic on University and 12th Street. And they said that these videos and outrage about fetal tissue has really just been a political ploy to illegally try to shut down these clinics because they offer abortion, which is legal in this country because of the United States Supreme Court. But Congressman Westerman, I asked him about that, and he, you have to listen pretty close, but he basically said, yes, I'm just shutting it down because of abortion.
Critics might say that it's not so much about fetal tissue research and those videos because there aren't any proposed bans in Congress about fetal tissue research. No one's going after the research institutions themselves that deal with fetal tissue. But this is really just about opposing abortion, and Planned Parenthood is one high-profile target that a lot of people can rally around.
The second reason I oppose the continuing resolution had to do with $700 million of fire funding that the Senate stuck in the continuing resolution.
So you see there, he answered very quickly. He said, well, yes, the reason I'm voting against Planned Parenthood is not just because the fetal tissue videos, it's because I'm against abortion, period. And then he immediately went on to talk about a forestry part of the continuing resolution.
Well, what's going to happen next? Obviously, funding for the time being continues. Is there any effort in the future that's going to be happening in Congress?
Yeah, since this was a short-term spending resolution, they still don't have another permanent fix. They'll have the same battle probably on December 11th. We'll have the same issues where abortion will still be legal in the United States because of the United States Supreme Court, and Republicans in Congress will still be trying to defund programs because they provide a legal medical service. One of the big differences would be John Boehner, the House Speaker, is stepping down, and he was seen as a more moderate influence. So we could have a new House Speaker in next time that might not have as much interest in continuing government funding. He might want to cause that kind of shutdown.
And on the topic of Boehner stepping down a week ago, have we heard any talk from members of our congressional delegation who they back as the Republican leader?
Not really. Based on Bruce Westerman's vote and a lot of the other members' votes, aligning themselves with the likes of Ted Cruz, you think they might be more vocal about it. But at this point, they haven't. And they're probably waiting for a lot of the leadership to settle and decide who's going to run, because at this point, there's still plenty of time for different people in the Republican Party to offer themselves up as candidates. But the leading one is McCarthy. I can't remember his first name, but he traveled.
Kevin McCarthy.
And he did a campaign stop with French Hill in Little Rock in 2014 at the well-spun tubular plant trying to advocate for Keystone XL.
Well, Chris, we had news this week that disappointed a lot of film fans that after 9 years, the Little Rock Film Festival has decided to call it quits.
Yeah, that's right. Back in 2006, a couple of filmmaking brothers, the Craig and Brent Renault, with the help of another filmmaker and a real estate investor here based in Little Rock, founded the Little Rock Film Festival. It started out as a small affair, and gradually it grew over the years. They got more sponsors and attracted more films, and started holding it in more venues around downtown Little Rock and North Little Rock. But yeah, this week they announced on their website, kind of matter-of-factly, and not a very big announcement anyways, it was just a small post on their blog, that they'd be ending it. And the Renault brothers, they're documentary filmmakers. They're grown to be pretty successful, and they're constantly shooting documentaries all around the world, really. They've won, you know, Peabody Awards this year, and they've done work for HBO and stuff. And they cite their inability to kind of keep up that work while also maintaining the kind of oversight of a festival that had grown to be one that attracted roughly 20,000 people per year here in Little Rock. And I spoke with a communication director for the film festival, or the guy who at least was the press person for this past year's film festival, Matt DeCampbell. And he kind of referenced how it was kind of a constant struggle to maintain enough sponsorship to really fund a working staff that could really dedicate themselves to this.
Since the festival began, it's been a matter of trying to break even each year, and that has been done through a amazing amount of volunteer hours, through some very passionate people, and a lot of dedicated time, and there have been some good sponsors, but there has not been I think some of the top line sustaining sponsors that help carry this type of festival on more stable ground from year to year, and so that's something that definitely did play into it. They did fight to break even every year, but on top of that, just the load on the Renaud brothers themselves, who have been at the head of this since it began.
So yeah, the Renaud, I had an email exchange with Brent Renaud, and he pointed out that, you know, the festival had its finances together. They were debt free. They just didn't have enough personnel dedicated to running this thing at the same level that they had risen to in these past couple of years. One of their problems was they were unable to get enough funding to hire a full-time executive director who could kind of plan the festival throughout the year. At the same time, I also spoke with Christopher Crane, the state film commissioner, and he kind of oversees the film incentives program, tax incentives, as well as providing production resources to filmmaking ventures in the state. He's very connected with projects and filmmakers throughout the state. And he kind of indicated that, or he believed, I guess, that somebody will likely take up the charge of restarting the festival. It may not happen next year, but the filmmaking community in the state is too large not to have a film festival here in the capital city.
Yeah, that he thinks someone will step in and fill the void.
Right, because one of the things that the Little Rock Film Festival is known for is really providing an outlet for those local filmmakers to display their work. Ones who may not get their work accepted at other festivals around the country, and have them all in a block. The Made in Arkansas block is always one of the more popular programs of each festival each year.
It is interesting because it seemed like something that's really popular, at least. People seem to talk about it a lot. It seemed exciting and kind of new for Little Rock. And so there is a lot of support for it, but it just shows, I guess, how much those two brothers really had to do for themselves. I guess because it's a relatively new community, there aren't a lot of people necessarily ready to take that mantle. But there are other things, like in Arkansas, the Hot Springs Film Festival, Bentonville.
The documentary film festival. Which begins a week from now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right.
And has had lots of its own financial struggles over the years.
Yeah, and that's a good thing to point out, because in talking with Brent Renaud, he kind of pointed to that festival as possibly being the new standard bearer for the state's local filmmakers. The Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival. Courtney Pledger, the executive director of that, she's been lauded, you know, by the filmmaking community for really having restarted and recalibrated that festival to a degree that it's starting to thrive a little bit more. Although, of course, you know, there is the obvious limitation that it can only accept documentary films, nonfiction films, and a lot of the submissions by local filmmakers were fiction. So,
well, on to the presidential race. Jacob, this week, former Governor Mike Huckabee announced leadership in several southern states, including Arkansas. And is this really, I mean, he hasn't been getting much traction during the presidential campaign, overshadowed by all the other excitement. This seems maybe kind of like a last-ditch effort to really try and shake things up and build some kind of momentum in some key states.
Yeah, Huckabee's poll numbers have pretty much fallen since the onset of this, and certainly not his performance that he had 8 years ago in Iowa when he kind of emerged as a surprise favorite, particularly because of his appeal among evangelicals, which you would expect with Huckabee, a former Baptist minister. But he announced four leadership teams in four southern states, Arkansas, Tennessee, North Carolina, and one other one. I can't remember.
Is it Georgia?
Yeah, Georgia. And he deemed these as part of his southern firewall. So just as you were saying, Michael, that I guess he's kind of saying, well, no matter what happens in Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina, where I'm having some trouble, maybe even this new SEC Southern primary and Super Tuesday, I can pick up enough votes to be a little bit more respectable. I think part of it is, I think after that Super Tuesday SEC primary with all those southern states, a lot of people will have to drop out of the race if they don't pick up anything by that point, because there'll be just too many states to go by with zero support to really stay in the race. So Huckabee, if he can win some southern states where he might have some natural appeal to fellow Southerners, to evangelicals, maybe that'll help him out. I spoke with Hal Bass, who's a political science professor at Mike Huckabee's alma mater, Ouachita Baptist University, and he said, well, Huckabee, if he doesn't win in Arkansas or the South, that's it.
His early campaign season prospects at this point don't look particularly good, and he needs to make a stand on his home turf, where the primary electorate includes large numbers of the white evangelicals who have been his mainstay in his previous presidential campaign.
But with the evangelical vote, Mike Huckabee is seeing other fellow evangelicals like Ben Carson and Ted Cruz take away a lot of that vote. But even people who are relatively non-religious, like Donald Trump, seem to be edging out Mike Huckabee for some of the evangelical vote. Even after Huckabee made a big public appearance with Kim Davis, the Kentucky clerk, preventing Ted Cruz from getting on the stage with him, really, he got to have that platform by himself, and it hasn't really picked up to the point where there's going to be another debate. There's a question whether or not he's going to make the main stage at this point, because his polling just has really fallen off since that first debate. I spoke with another political scientist, Greg Shufelt at UALR, about these leadership teams, which are basically big lists of endorsements of state representatives and some pastors and things like that. You know, do these really matter at all?
That's really in the eye of the beholder. Some of these people on this list will do nothing more than agree to attach their names. What's really going to make an impact is come primary time if these elected officials, specifically the governors or senators or members of Congress, lend their campaign organization to assist the governor. That would be what makes a difference. But otherwise, this is a very impressive list. But if it doesn't translate into action, doesn't translate into checks or a list of supporters, it's kind of an empty gesture.
But he is right. He does have most of the big names in Arkansas politics backing him. And you would think that would give him a little bit of momentum, at least here in his home state or former home state.
Right. And a lot of people on that list owe some of their political careers in some ways to Governor Huckabee, who was one of the first people to take statewide office in this big Republican push that we've seen over the past 10 years or so. And he had virtually everybody, right, from Arkansas. Noticeably absent, though, was Tom Cotton. And there was also not a single member of the state House or state Senate leadership that opted to sign on to this. I'm not sure if they've signed on to leadership teams with anybody else necessarily. But in Tennessee, North Carolina, and Georgia, he also got at least one congressman in each state and Georgia's governor. So he's got a little bit of ground there. If those people are going to be active, you could think he could maybe pick up some of the delegates in those contests, if not all of them.
And what do you make of Tom Cotton? We, of course, have one state lawmaker backing a draft Cotton for president.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that on last week's podcast. You know, at this point, Tom Cotton says he's not going to run. If he is going to run, he's going to enter a very crowded field. It seems like we'll know what he'll talk about. He'll talk about the Iran deal. He'll talk about military investment and things like that. And it'll be a message that I think will be well received if he would run, but it's also a message that generally every other candidate has too.
Well, and I've heard talk, well, maybe 2020, if a Republican doesn't win this time, might be when there's talk that at some point Tom Cotton will emerge on the national stage. You and I have talked recently just about he always seems to be on TV constantly. He's on the national networks. It's like, oh, Tom Cotton's on CNN again today. You know that, and why is that? When someone so quickly, you know, it becomes such a regular go-to person for these national shows.
Well, he definitely wants to be a high-profile guy. That's he, and it's not just because he's attention-seeking necessarily. It's because he believes, you know, he's one of the most serious positions in the world, and he's going to use it, and it's a rare opportunity, and he's really going to take advantage of it. I think it's been said of him, particularly when he had that letter that he sent out to the government of Iran, which in itself is like a high-profile move that most congressmen don't make, that it was said that he was working, calling people before he'd even taken his office. He's still in a temporary office in the basement, but he really works hard at this, and he really wants to do it. If he's going to run in 20, the state legislature cleared the path for him, allowing him to run both for the Senate and for the presidency at the same time. A lot of states have done that. Joseph Lieberman, when he ran for vice president, had the same thing happen.
And he could end up being named as a vice presidential candidate this. I mean, it's too early to speculate too much, but I mean,
and it's all a little weird to me that they're narrowing that we feel compelled to narrow down the GOP field at this point. We haven't had a single caucus yet. You know, you could let the voters of Iowa narrow down the field.
Well, on the topic of the presidency, but former president Chris, we had former President Bill Clinton come back to Little Rock and on Friday dedicate a new permanent installation there on the grounds of his presidential library, invoking the spirit of a young Jewish girl who hid with her family from the Nazis during World War II, Anne Frank, whose diary a lot of people read when they're in school, giving the vantage point, the perspective of a child in that the Holocaust. And but tell me a little bit about the ceremony. This was for the dedication of a sapling that comes from a tree that was outside the building in Amsterdam where Anne Frank and her family hid.
Right. And Anne Frank, I haven't read the diary myself, I must admit, but she...
I think it was required reading when I was in school. It may or may not be anymore.
Obviously, from all accounts, a compelling narrative. And certainly one that we can all learn from. But yeah, she did reference that tree, a chestnut tree in her garden outside her window of the annex that she and her family hid in for 2 years in Amsterdam before the Nazis found her and later tragically shipped off to an extermination camp. But yeah, Bill Clinton was in town to dedicate this sapling, which right now is still in a greenhouse getting acclimated to the Arkansas weather. But there are several other saplings like this being planted around the world as kind of a sign of peace and unity and remembering kind of a not so wholesome history as a means of creating a dialogue to affect change for the better in this world. And that was basically Clinton's message when he spoke today. He was accompanied by the executive director of the Clinton Foundation and the executive director of the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, who made the trip down. They each said some words. Clinton, he referenced a lot of events in Arkansas history that were not so great, I guess. He talked about the Indian Removal Act of the 1830 and how that removed the Quapaw tribe from Arkansas, the internment of Japanese Americans in the Rowan camp.
Rower and Jerome. There were two in Arkansas.
Oh, okay.
Right, during World War II, yeah.
Yeah, and also the desegregation saga beginning with Little Rock Central High School in 1957. And those three events are referenced in panels that are already in place surrounding where the tree will be planted on the Clinton grounds with quotes from people who experienced that history. And the whole point of like I said, is just to offer kind of a means of remembrance and reflection on terrible events in human history as a learning opportunity.
Well, let's give a listen to the former president's remarks.
And here he is talking about some of the Arkansas events.
When I was a young boy growing up, I used to spend some time in western Arkansas near Hot Springs, where I grew up, on what was part of the Trail of Tears. I memorized the names of all the Indian tribes who were marched across our state, torn from their homes. I learned about the Quapaw. Were removed from their land in this state, not once, but twice. To get away with doing that, they had to be viewed as subhuman. Truth is, greedy people wanted the land. Never occurred to them whether they were subhuman or not till they wanted the land. People have been manipulated throughout human history and dehumanized by people who had no soul, but did understand power and wealth. I have toured the sites of the Japanese internment camps in Arkansas and made the friendship late in his life of a remarkable Japanese-American named George Ishiyama, who in later life, when he was in his 70s, was on the board of Murphy Oil Company. But when he was in his 20s, was an aide to the Secretary of the Interior, Harold Ickes, in overseeing the Japanese internment camps, including those in Arkansas. Ickes disapproved of the camps and picked a young Japanese-American, brilliant man, to try to humanize an inhumane situation. One Arkansan, the former mayor of Dumas, Rosalie Gould of McGee, has spent much of the last 30 years trying to preserve the memory of those camps and to recognize the integrity and honor of the Japanese people who were held in them. We'll be able to remember them because of this. And of course, every living Arkansan knows the story of the Little Rock Nine. But you need to know that there is a long history here. Not just the slaves that came to Arkansas, but one of the most shameful things ever done in the slaveholding states, beginning in the 1850s, the South was full of free African Americans, and legislature after legislature after legislature, posse thug after posse thug after posse thug ran the free blacks out of the South so that they would not encourage the slaves to rise up for their freedom. All of that we will remember here. When it comes down to it, we can thank a little girl for staying alive beyond her death.
His message was basically one that through remembering, we can affect a more hopeful stance in human relations. And one of the things he later referenced in his talk was what he considered to be one of the greater accomplishments of his presidency, which was the federal funding of the Human Genome Project. And the reason he brought that up was because he wanted to highlight that although human beings and cultures and societies and nationalities tend to see their differences, one of the main findings of the Human Genome Project was that, well, even though there might be visible differences between us, 99% of our genomic makeup is exactly alike. So it was a nice day. Of course, it's always great to see a former president speak as just for a historic purpose. Everyone in the audience, there are a lot of school children there, a few hundred school children from schools around Central Arkansas. I'm sure many of them have had to read, or maybe hopefully chose to read Anne Frank's diary.
Yeah, and you know, you're right about Clinton. He does seem a lot more reflective whenever he speaks here. So it's usually very enjoyable to hear him talk like that.
Mm-hmm. And just down the road from where he made those remarks about the Quapaw are trying to come back to Arkansas.
Right.
And I'm not going to say that what Clinton said is accurate about today, but we have a situation where the Quapaw want to come back to this land. They want to have self-governance as much as allowed by the United States and is legal to them under the United States government. And the city is pretty tepid about it because they are worried that that land, they wanted that land to be part of a future port expansion.
And they're afraid that the Quapaw have designs to build a casino or something, even though the Quapaw chairman has said repeatedly that that's not the intention, that they're merely trying to preserve that land and do an archaeological dig on the burial grounds that are there. But
yeah, and fundamentally, they just don't want the Quapaw to have that much autonomy in the middle of Arkansas.
Well, with that, I think we're done for the week. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. We'll be back here next week. Chris Hickey prepared the theme music you hear each week. KUAR is a service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. You can find us online at kuar.org.